This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Read Like a Writer is the books podcast from Faber & Faber, Serpent's Tale and Canongate, three independent publishers bringing the voices and the book recommendations of their authors to your ears. It's hosted by me, Anna Fielding, and in each episode we'll hear about the books closest to these authors' hearts, their latest projects, and learn a bit about their local independent bookshop too. This week we're in Edinburgh, as a special treat to coincide with the book festival, and our guest right now in the studio is Carmen Maria Machado. Carmen has written fiction, criticism and essays for many publications, including Granter and The New Yorker. Her first book, Her Body and Other Parties, is an inventive and absorbing collection of short stories, bending fairy tale, urban myth, horror and fantasy with a feminine and feminist approach. As I've said, we're in Edinburgh today, and Carmen, who lives in Philadelphia with her wife, has come all the way in to meet us. So thank you for that epic journey, Carmen.
Of course, thank you for having me.
And how are you finding Edinburgh so far?
It's beautiful. I love... Also, you can tell I'm a little sick, so pardon me. But yeah, I love the moodiness of the weather. I'm really enjoying the cold and the... It was raining last night, and I was like, oh, it's so like dramatic and... I don't know. I've been enjoying it. So
I find that a very generous interpretation.
I like weather with drama. When I go to a place like LA, I mean, I love LA, but like in LA, the weather is so boring. Like it's just the same. It's beautiful and perfect every day. And I'm like, this is very, it's routine. It's not interesting.
Well, no one from Los Angeles.
I get angry emails from people. I love LA. I said that.
It has many charms.
It has many charms, but the weather is boring.
So talking about Her Body and Other Parties, the first story in the collection, which is The Husband's Stitch, I think it really sets out your stall. You have this wonderful kind of lustful heroine, and she, and also by extension you, have woven through so many stories that we already know. You know, she's telling fairy tales to her son, first in a sort of cleaned up version, and then as he gets older with a bit more gore. And then there are a load of modern urban myths too, like the one about the serial killer with the hook waiting on top of the car. How do you find sort of building more stories with stories?
I mean, I've always been really drawn to narratives, what I call nested narratives, so like narratives that have stories within them. And so, yeah, like when I was writing that story, actually the first draft of that story didn't have any of those other myths or legends. It was just the story of the girl with the ribbon around her neck growing into a woman and going through her marriage. And so the first draft I remember reading it to my wife, and she absolutely loved it, but I was thinking to myself, like, there's something missing, like, this is not a complete version of this story. I need to sort of go back into it and think about it. And then I was thinking about urban legends and myths and fairy tales and the way that stories with oral traditions get sort of passed around and retold, and the retellings and the way that the stories shift and change, like, has a lot to, like, tells us a lot about ourselves and what we're interested in and who we are as people and as, you know, in various eras and things like that. So I was just really interested in having that effect. And so then, later when I went back, I just found myself, using all these other stories as like little mirrors to sort of give to her, to sort of reflect like the world that she's in and by extension the world that we're in.
I think it works quite well as a device because you know those stories too. Mm-hmm. And so it pulls you in to sort of thinking about things from her perspective because you know those stories that she's telling as
well. Yeah, absolutely.
So taking forms and sort of twisting them and things is something you've done a couple more times throughout the collection as well. So, you know, with Especially Heinous, which is a sort of really surreal sense of a set of plot synopses for Law and Order SVU. And then Inventory, which I loved, which I'm not going to talk about actually much because I think spoiling the twist at the end will ruin it for anyone who's listening because I sort of sat up in the cafe I was reading with and went, oh! But it really does a nice play on that classic everyone I've ever slept with list, which I think so many people have made at some time. So going on that, there's a lot of writing about sex that you do as well, and Real Women Have Bodies is an interesting case in point. This shows the relationship between two girls at the same time as there's a disease of some kind that's causing women to become incorporeal, insubstantial. But the sex that they have is very grounded in realism, even though a lot of their surrounding is quite magical. So I was just wondering how you, one, start writing about sex in such a realistic way without it sounding hammy, and secondly, how it kind of incorporates in a world where so much else is fantastical.
Yeah, well, how to make it write sex without sounding hammy is sort of like the million-dollar question. And it honestly, I mean, for every sex scene that I write that I'm satisfied with, there are lots that I discard. And I can't, or I have to sort of strip the scene back a little bit because it's like too much. And it's funny. And I mean, when I started reading fiction, you know, I love a story with a sex scene as much as anyone else. Maybe other people won't admit it, but I'll admit it. But oftentimes when I was reading what I guess you'd call sort of literary fiction or fiction where there was a lot of attention being paid to things like language and detail, language and character, stories not explicitly written, you know, it's not erotica, not written for the sexual content, but with a lot of sexual content. I found myself often reading books by like straight men and I found it incredibly boring. Like I was like, I'm just not interested. After a while, I get really bored hearing about women's bodies through the lens of straight men. And it just sounded interesting to me. And I want queer sex and I want sex where women, regardless of their sexual orientation, it's from their perspective. You know, and there are certain writers who do really beautiful jobs with that, like Lydia Yuknovich, who's a writer who I really enjoy, does these really just like sexy, weird books that just have like a lot of really sort of female-bodied centric sex scenes that I really enjoy. But yeah, I mean, the trick is just to, I mean, or not the trick, but it makes it sound so sort of cheesy, but like just sort of thinking about, I really need to like try to like push past the metaphors that you would think it's okay to use. Like people will ask me about like why I choose, but I can swear on this, or I can say, yeah, I thought so. It's a podcast, right? Okay. Yeah. Like, you know, so people, sometimes they get very embarrassed and they'll say like, oh, we want to use like really weird words. So it was like manhood. And I'm like, no, just say cock. Like, why is it so hard? You know, or like, you know, there's all these like, other, they'll be like, oh, the down there. And I'm like, no, just say cunt or say pussy or say whatever, like say the word. You know, and then like we'll just push past it, right? And like, and then it's just like a word that the character is using, and it works. So I feel like people get very like tied up about that sort of thing, and I just sort of make my choices and stick with them, and just sort of try to. And also, the sex is always, you know, my objective is like I want the scene to be sexy, but I also want it to be advancing some kind of plot. Like I want, you know, it's part of the story, it's part of the character, it's part of the world that they're in. So yeah, so I mean it's always fun. I enjoy writing them. You know, it's great. So
I mean, yeah, to carry on as well, it's one of the things that I've really liked about all of your work is that there's enough realism in there to anchor the magic realist bits and make them believable. It's almost like there's a groundingness of day-to-day world that allows the sort of more fantastical elements to cling on.
Right. And like, you know, whenever I'm writing anything, whether it's horror or fantasy or other, you know, other writers write, like, I mean, there's obviously millions of genres and variations on genres, but I'm always really interested in the way the body plays into any of those elements. So like even science fiction, even fantasy, like where is the body and how is the body interacting in that world, regardless of the circumstances around it. And sex and sexual desire is like a way that the body can serve as that anchor.
You've also gone in for in a very different physical realm, full on body horror in one of the stories where the description of those pustules will stay with me.
I once did a reading in New York, and this man, I was like reading that scene from The Resident, and this man just in the middle audience was just like, oh no, like he just like exclaimed like in the middle of the reading. It was like clearly just involuntary, like he was just so like upset by what I was reading, like he just like shouted. It was like really intense. Yeah, I mean, body horror for the same reasons, actually. That sort of visceral. I mean, it's in a way, it's not that different than a sex scene, right? It's like
not really.
Very visceral. Again, the body serves as an anchor. So the body horror is very interesting to me.
I was eating a smoked salmon sandwich while I was reading that.
I'm so sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. I hope you're not put off of smoked salmon forever. That would be really tragic.
But it's going to be a couple of weeks at least, I think. So, moving on to your favorite bookshop. Can you tell me which bookshop you've chosen?
So, it's hard to pick one, but I'd say, can I say two? Is that okay? Is that allowed?
Let's be rebels. We'll break the rules.
Okay, yeah. Sure. So probably my favorite ever is Prairie Lights in Iowa City, Iowa, which is just this amazing store that has just incredible selection. The sellers are very discerning. They have just, you know, the books that they choose and the books that they sell are just really incredible. It's like just a really lovely selection. And they do like incredible events because Iowa City has a lot of writers coming through it because of the workshop that's there. So they just, when I was living in Iowa City, you know, there would just be these incredible events at Prairie Lights. And I really loved it. And then in Philadelphia, where I live now, there's this really wonderful bookshop called Joseph Fox, which is in Center City. And it's this incredibly tiny, but again, this beautifully curated bookshop. And they always have something, you know, even if they don't have, I'll go in and be like, do you have this title? But like, they'll be like, I don't, but here is this like perfect thing that you want and that you need. And we have picked it because we love it, and they'll give it to you, and you know, they'll sell it to you, and it's always like amazing. So yeah, so Joseph Fox is my favorite in Philadelphia.
We'll come back to Philadelphia in a second, but you were actually part of the Iowa Writers Workshop as well, weren't
you?
Yes,
I was. Mm-hmm.
How did you find the experience?
I loved it. You know, people have a lot of feelings about MFA programs that I can't even get into it because I have so many thoughts and feelings about it. But I loved Iowa. You know, I had 2 years, funded years, to write. And that's really a gift that I will never have again. And I really sort of, I got a lot of work done. I like found my voice as a writer, not necessarily because I like went and people think of it as like, you know, oh, you go in and you are taught that. But it wasn't that I was taught that. It was that I went into this program where there were like lots of other brilliant writers, both as teachers and as students. And people were just really thoughtful and smart and, you know, recommended books to me and like, were like, you know, that story that you wrote last week, like have you read this person? Like, you should read this person. And I just found myself really like expanding. I mean, my work just really I found my voice when I was there and, got a lot of work done and it was just a really wonderful experience and I miss it all the time. And it feels like it just happened yesterday, but it happened like I graduated like 6 years ago, which is pretty crazy. But, yeah, I loved it.
And you're now a writer in residence at the University of Pennsylvania.
Yes.
Moving it back to your current hometown, which is Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. So telling us about the bookshop there, when you first walk in and you're going shopping, what's the first thing you see as you walk into John Fox in Philadelphia?
Oh, Joseph Fox.
Joseph Fox.
Yeah. No worries. So it's up some steps. So you walk in and there's like these little, I don't know what they're called, those like metal stands that spin around.
Carousel.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. So they're like a bunch of little carousels that have a lot of the staff recommended books. And it'll have a little card. They'll say, you know, like whose recommendation it is. And they do like a really beautiful display up in the front. And then to the left is where the booksellers are all sitting. And there's a couple of registers and there's always somebody there and they're always so lovely and chatty. And then the bookstore kind of just goes back. So there's like a long bookshelf and like a tiny little hallway. And then you sort of go to the back. So all told, it's probably not much bigger than the studio we're in now, I think, when you probably like add together all the space. But they're just, like I said, it's just really beautifully curated. Like, you know, whenever you go to a section, like, you know, if I go to the nonfiction, I know I'm going to find something really, really interesting there, even if it's not necessarily what I was looking for. And all the booksellers are just like the sweetest, loveliest people. And they don't do events in the store because it's so small, but they basically do all the bookselling for like the public library. So like if you go to an event at the public library, they'll be there as the official bookseller. So yeah, they're just fantastic.
So they're Philadelphia's top guys, and we should all keep them in memory to visit them.
You should. I mean, there's a lot of really great bookstores in Philly, but Joseph Fox is just my favorite. And yeah, if you're in Center City, which is where a lot of people go, like it's, like I said, it's small, but if you're looking for like a new book that you didn't know it existed, but you know, you tell them what you like they can find you a really, really good title. So yeah, Joseph Fox.
That sounds brilliant. We're going to talk about the books that you're about to recommend to people now as well. And, they're all ones that, in a very similar way to you, about reimagining myths and fairy tales and legends and history. So kicking off with one of my favourites, Daisy Johnson, who's currently on the Booker long list, with her reinterpretation of the Oedipus myth.
Yes, Everything Under, which I just got to read this summer. It's actually in the States. It's coming out with my publisher, Grey Wolf. So I was incredibly excited to get to read it. And I just absolutely adored it. It was... just really, it's funny because actually as I started reading it, I didn't realize it was the Oedipus myth as I started reading it. And so I was going like this, it's weird. I feel like there's some familiar like elements in this book. And then when I sort of got to like, I don't want to give too much away, but like when I got to the parts where I suddenly realized what it was, I was like, oh shit, like this is amazing. But yeah, it's set in this, this like world of like riverboats in England, which I didn't really know much about this community or a bunch about it, but it was just completely addictive. I tore through it in one sitting. I just absolutely loved it. Yeah. And of course, then I was thinking a lot about, you know, because Oedipus is such a strange story. When you first learn it, when you're like a kid, when you're like young, like a teenager, you're like, that's a you know, destined to like sleep with your mother and kill your father. And it's so like dramatic and weird. And, you know, there's something very just like strange about it. And she does such a beautiful job, like using that as a lens to sort of interrogate questions about identity. And yeah, the setting was just really addictive. I just absolutely loved it. So yeah, I would absolutely recommend that title. Is it out? It's out here.
It is out here.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. I absolutely love Daisy Johnson. So
yeah, because her first collection was also short stories,
yes,
as well, Fen.
Yeah.
And I think very like you as well. She's also used that sort of frame of magic realism to look at the stories of women and girls in a different way. You know, she's addressed anorexia or domestic violence, but it's completely original because of the way she's done it.
Yeah, she's incredibly smart. I really, really like her a lot.
So she kicked off with a book of short stories and then turned into a novel. Will we see a novel from you next? Or?
well, I'm working on a memoir right now. It's my next book that's actually coming out that I've sold. I would like to write a novel. I don't know how. I'm trying to teach myself. It's very difficult. And I admire all writers who go from the short story form into the novel form because it's such a different just way of thinking about your project. It's like, you know, the short story, I feel like with the short story, it's very contained and I can sort of think about it in my head, sort of hold it in my head in one shot. But with a novel, there's just pieces going everywhere. And honestly, when I read novels, and even right now I'm working on this memoir and it's a full length book, like even trying to keep all the pieces, and it's my own life. Like it's not even like stuff I'm making up. It's like things that happened in my life, but trying to like kind of keep all the pieces in my head is like really difficult. So honestly, I admire novel writers. I want to write a novel. We'll see. We'll see how that goes.
But I mean, there's enough discipline in short stories anyway.
Right.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Moving on to another collection of short stories. This one's a classic. This is Angela Carter's The Bloody Chamber and Other Stories.
So good. Yes. So when I was in graduate school, I remember, and this is what I meant when I said that, like, I learned so much when I was there. A friend read a story of mine and said, have you ever read, or she was talking about Angela Carter, and I was like, oh, I've never read any of her. And she was like, what? You know? And that voice where they're like, I'm about to change your life. And she was like, she's amazing, but you should go read The Bloody Chamber. And I did. And it did change my life. I mean, it really, you know, Angela Carter died too young. I mean, she was incredibly prolific even in her short life. But when I think about The Bloody Chamber and how that book, I think, influenced just like an entire generation of writers who have tackled sort of thinking about myth and fairy tale. But the audacity of The Bloody Chamber is, you know, the way it sort of addresses violence and sex, and the fact that she has like multiple retellings of the same story in one book, which is like just, when I first read it, I was like, wait, is this another Beauty and the Beast story? Like right after this other one? That's ridiculous. That's amazing. Like that's just so, and they're really different from each other. And one of them is incredibly sexy. Like it's just this like, you know, everything that she wrote and her language, like her sentences are just like, it's just like decadent and ridiculous. And every sentence I'm like, how does she even get away with that? It's like being at a carnival permanently. Like, it's just like, you know, every sentence is incredible. And like her Puss in Boots, which is like so fun and weird. I'm just like, really, yeah, that collection really just really, and I think it really changed how I wrote, like how I thought about sentences, how I thought about how prose is so integral to the experience of reading. And now, you know, if I read a book that I otherwise would really love, but the prose is not up to snuff, which doesn't mean that it's always ornate. Like if the prose is not being thought about in some meaningful way, I like can't read the book. Cause I'm just like, I need those sentences. I need them to be telling me something. And I feel like her sentences did so much work, which is really wonderful.
She's a beautiful, beautiful writer on a kind of microstructural level.
Yeah.
I also think there's something really satisfying, especially on your first reading, of seeing someone wrest control of a story that you've heard so many times before. You know, you have that different ending when the mother comes in at the end of The Bloody Chamber and just shoots the person who's about to kill her daughter.
Oh, it's so good. When the mother puts a bullet between Bluebeard's eyes. When the mother comes in and the horse is like rearing, it's such a good, the image. I mean, that, and they're all amazing. That one is probably my favorite. I mean, The Bloody Chamber, the title story, you know, which is the Bluebeard retelling, is just so stunning and so strange. And yeah, and that, I mean, this is sort of the trick of the fairy tale or any kind of like retelling of an existing tale, which is that, yeah, you're fighting against, it's like you're telling a story that people generally have heard. And so the question is like, how do you make that fresh, and how do you use it to examine things that maybe somebody has not examined yet? How do you sort of take the underlying assumptions of that story and like, yeah, do something completely new with it? And people try it all the time. I think people think it's going to be easy. And then oftentimes I'll read retellings. I mean, I won't say any names, but like I'll read them and I'll be like, eh, like that, yeah, you know, okay, fine. Like that is a retelling. But like, that's all I can really say about it. But when you read a writer who does it well, where they're like really completely reconfiguring it in their mind and then in your mind. It's like such a special experience, and I love it.
Yeah, there's one that actually called to mind for me, which is a completely different writer writing for a completely different audience, which is Roald Dahl's series of poems for children.
Oh,
and he has Red Riding Hood do something very similar and come in and shoot the wolf. all at once, her eyelid flickers, she whips a pistol from her knickers.
Oh my God. I love that you can just pull that out. You just know.
It's an integral part of a British childhood.
That oh, really? Oh, interesting.
Talk about Confessions of the Fox by Jordi Rosenberg.
Yes. Confessions of the Fox was a book that I also received. I don't know if it's out here. It must be out here.
Is it already
out? It just came out in the States. It blew my head off. I mean, I was I get a lot of advanced copies of books, as I review, I had gotten it in the mail and brought it with me to this residency, and I actually was going to, I was in New Mexico and I was going to some hot springs, and I was like, well, I should bring an ARC with me. I don't know if you call them that. Do you call them that? ARCs or advanced reader copies, like galleys or whatever. And I was like, I need a book that if I drop it in the hot springs, it's not a big deal. Cause it's not a finished book. And I devoured it. So it's this retelling of Mack the Knife and Threepenny Opera, this like English folk hero. It's incredibly queer. It's just like gender queer and queer story. It has this sort of other narrative happening. So sort of the frame of this, of the novel, is that this academic has discovered this telling of the story that tells us a lot of things about this character that we didn't know before, and is sort of this like kind of satire of like academia. So there's sort of this funny, weird, very like intense, like footnotes, and there's an introduction, and it's like really, really beautiful, and really funny. And then this like incredibly fascinating and like romp of a story sort of happening in the main text. And it just knocked my socks off. Like I read it. I mean, again, it was like, when I was so pruny, I had to get out of the hot springs or I was going to fall to pieces. I was like, okay, I'm going to drive home and I'm going to keep reading this book, cause I just didn't want to stop reading it. And it's so funny. It's so good. It's like nothing I've ever read before. It's like the queerest book I've read in years. It's just this absolute fucking delight. Like I could not get over how amazing it was. So yeah, Confessions of the Fox. I'm just insane. I don't know. I'm in love this book so much. I just like want to just run screaming to people and just like thrusting it in their arms. Like, I'm like, everybody should read this novel. It's so good. And it's like, I'm not as into historical novels traditionally. There are some that I like, but it's not a genre that I pick up a lot. But I was like, man, if every historical novel was like this, I would read all of them. I just want to read more books that are like this. So yeah, I just absolutely loved it.
That, I think, is the most fulsome phrase I've ever heard.
Well, also, and it's just like, this is the pleasure of the retelling, is that it allows you to reimagine. So like in this case, like reimagining this character as a trans man and like using it as this lens to examine like the way we conceive of gender and sexuality and have historically conceived of those things. And that's the magic, is like, you can just be like, oh, we actually knew this story wrong all along, and here's the real version. And that is just brilliant, and really, I don't know, it just makes me so happy, and it's like such a fun and smart way to sort of approach that project of like reinterpreting an existing story.
We're going to move on to Emma Donoghue, I think, who most listeners are going to know from Room, mm-hmm. which was such a big book from her. But we're going to talk about something that she released actually several years ago in 1997, which is Kissing the Witch. It was published as a book for adults in the UK and as a young adult book in the US.
Yes, which I actually find incredibly odd. I don't know. I mean, I know this happens a lot with like books. Like there was this book that came out years ago called The Book Thief, which was huge in the States, but they released it as a young adult book in the States, but it was released, I don't know about here, but like in Australia and like New Zealand, they had released it as an adult book.
Me too.
Oh yeah. So but I remember like, so it's interesting. Yeah. When I realized they'd released it in the Kissing the Witch as a young adult book, I was like, that's so interesting. Like, not that they couldn't, it was just an interesting choice. Anyway.
And Donoghue herself said it actually brought her a lot of new and younger fans, so she was quite pleased in the
end.
Oh,
that's wonderful. Yeah. No, that's great. And I mean, I feel like, and I could see that book was sort of being like the Bloody Chamber for, like, older teens. Like, I could sort of see that being a gateway drug into, like, the world of, like, fairy tale retellings. Because, yeah, the, oh my God, Kissing the Witch is so lovely. So it's these nested narratives. So it starts off with, like, a Cinderella retelling, and then she asks this woman, who were you before you became the character you are in this story? And she's like, well, I'll tell you this tale. And then she tells a tale that's like a retelling of another fairy tale. And then just keeps, and then every character keeps saying, like, who are you to this other person in the story? And it goes back and back and back and back and back. And they're just like telling all these really beautiful, also very queer, like, retellings of a lot of traditional fairy tales. Donkey Skin and Sleeping Beauty and Rapunzel and Beauty and the Beast and, or Rose Red and all those stories. And it has that, like, really beautiful sort of, like, you know, there's a lot of ways to think about fairy tales. There's this really great essay by Kate Bernheimer that I love. She's a writer who writes, she rewrites fairy tales, and she also edits the Fairy Tale Review in the United States, which is, like, a really wonderful magazine. And she has this really great essay where she talks about the form of the fairy tale and, like, what fairy tales and traditional fairy tales sort of have as a structure. And so it talks about, like, you know, normalized magic and that sort of flatness of, like, character that is very common. You know, it's the witch, the girl, the boy, the sparrow, the mother, whatever. And so while, like, a writer like Angela Carter is taking those myths and, or taking those fairy tales and, like, shaping them into this very, like, lush, ornate, like, three-dimensional thing, Kissing the Witch, I feel like, is also sort of engaging, not quite as flat as a traditional telling, but she sort of keeps that fairy tale tone, which is incredibly interesting to me. Because a lot of people, when they retell it, they're like, ugh. Like, I want to make all these characters, like, more three-dimensional. But she keeps that sort of, like, almost like abstraction, this quality of abstraction that I think is incredibly interesting. And those stories are just so beautiful. And I love the way that they sort of nestle into each other. It's like a Russian doll, like a nesting doll. It's so beautiful.
It's interesting, actually, because one of the things that I found, and as you mentioned, she keeps very close to that sort of trad fairy tale tone. But she also credits the version of the fairy tale that she's taken it from. Yes. So she says, oh, this is from the Hans Andersen version, or this is based on the Grimm version, as opposed to them just being sort of floating in general culture.
Right.
So I quite like that idea. It's also interesting, actually, that you mentioned Donkey Skin, because that is one that does not get used very often in
because it's so, like, similarly to Oedipus, because it's got, like, this weird incest vibe to it, you know. And it's very creepy and sort of sexually violent. And, like, yeah, I actually am really interested in that fairy. I mean, I would like to say I like it as a strong word, but I'm very interested in Donkey Skin. And especially, I think, because it's not as common as, like, the Little Mermaid, you know, because it's just way more, it's, like, harder to explain to children. So people are just like,
Briefly, for listeners who aren't familiar with the fairy tale we're talking about, Donkey Skin is the story essentially of a father trying to force his daughter to marry him. And in various different ways, she disguises herself in a piece of donkey skin as an ass and escapes. You can see why it doesn't get remade that often or told to children.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, but I feel like there's something really, and the version that she does in this, again, I don't want to give it too much away, but the version she does is just, like, really, again, when I was reading it, I was not as familiar with Donkey Skin the first time I read Kissing the Witch. And when I finally, like, sort of looked it up, I was like, because I was like, this is a disturbing story. And then I was like, oh, the source material is even more disturbing.
I first came across it in a more academic context in Marina Warner's From the Beast to the Blonde, which was the first time I'd ever heard the story. I think it had just not been part of my...
Yeah. Well, also, and it sort of engages in that sort of idea of, like, the monstrous feminine, the fact that, like, to escape sexual violence, this thing that she doesn't want, she has to, like, sort of make herself into this, like, and the, I mean, in the Emma Donoghue version, like, you know, she's, it's like, it smells like shit and it's, like, bloody and gross. And, like, she just becomes this sort of, like, animalistic sort of figure, this vagabond. And, like, it's just, it's so intense. It's just, like, a really intense version, I think, or it's just an intense story. And she does a really amazing job of reimagining it.
It's interesting because she's been quite clever about using the tropes of the fairy tale in a metaphorical way. I read an interview, she said, I was thinking about it, what if Thumbelina just felt small rather than being a miniature woman? I thought it was
that's sort of like, you know, in the version of Snow White that she's telling, it's like the Snow White, or not Snow, sorry, not Snow White, Sleeping Beauty. In the version she tells of Sleeping Beauty, like, the sleep is, like, metaphorical, like the sleep is just, you know, I was this, like, she's this very, like, privileged girl who just doesn't know what pain is. And that's the version of sleep that exists in that story. And yeah, I really admired that. And because I kind of, you know, because I, in those stories, it was easier to sort of tell as I was reading them, like, what the source material was, like, you know. But when I got to, when I started to realize some of these, like, I was waiting for her to fall asleep. And then at some point I was like, oh, she is asleep already. Like, that's sort of the whole point of the story, which I absolutely loved. So yeah, she does an amazing job with that. I love that book.
And going on to our final one, which is Helen Oyemi's Boy Snow Bird, which is a retelling of Snow White. It's so rich in layers of secrets and ideas about identity. And the whole thing starts out with a girl called Boy.
Yeah. So this book is really interesting. And I think, you know, I was I was thinking about it and sort of rereading it for this interview. And I was thinking about it as the first time I read it and then rereading it. And the thing that's interesting about that book. So, yeah, it's basically this sort of, it's a very loose adaptation of Snow White, reset in like the 50s, and deals with sort of race and passing and, you know, sort of these various like levels of privilege and thinking about, yeah, just thinking about race in this way. And then the ending, and then I was sort of reading, and I read the ending and I was like, huh. And I don't want to give too much away, but I will say that the ending, I think it could be argued is kind of transphobic. But I think it's just like a thing to know sort of going into it. But I think it's really interesting because, you know, we sort of assume that, like, I feel like there's a sort of sense that people have this almost like, I don't want to say arrogance, but we're like, oh, I'm going to interpret a fairy tale to make it like modern or to like think about it in a different way. But like also because like the original is flawed for XYZ reasons, or the original like is very old fashioned in this way. But also sometimes like the reinterpretations tell us just as much about like our own assumptions and our own culture and our own time and place that we live in. As much as the original stories did, actually. So like, you know, reading it, I think like, you know, I don't know if this novel could have gotten, I mean, I don't actually know how old, do you know when it actually came out I only read it a few years ago for the first time, but.
It's relatively recent. I think it's 3 or 4 years.
Okay. Yeah. I feel like the conversation about like gender has like changed fairly recently. And I think, I wonder if like the exact plot of this book would be, that the ending would have been the same if it was published now or like in the future. But yeah, but it's also like, you know, her style, I love Helen Oyemi, and her style is so like bizarre, sort of hallucinatory and dreamy. And her sentences are so beautiful and weird. And like, she's just like a really interesting, and she also, you know, she has a lot of other like interpretations of, you know, she has like a Mr. Fox, which is like a Bluebeard, you know, sort of like a Bluebeard retelling or a sort of play on Bluebeard.
It's like Bluebeard and Reynard Dean sort of jammed together.
Yeah. It's so she's obviously very interested. Like that's something that she's very interested in, like myth and the ways in which those things can sort of be put through her very like strained sort of like, I don't want to say Lynchian exactly, but like the sort of hallucinatory, like dreamy lens that is like her sort of identity as a writer. Yeah, I absolutely love, I just love her. And so that book is really interesting. And I think, despite that ending, which I sort of have a lot of thoughts about, but like, I really just, yeah, that book is so fascinating to me. And I just love the way that she uses, Snow White of all stories. And you know, it's funny, 'cause like when you read Snow White, that sort of image of like skin as white as snow, you know, which is like part of that, you know, sort of incantatory quality, you know, lips as red as blood, hair as black as, I think it's ebony on the windowsill, and then skin as white as snow. And like, you know, taking that and like unpacking it into this like huge, weird, beautiful book, is just quite a feat, and I think is incredibly interesting. So yeah. And it reflects like a really interesting ways of thinking about things like race, and then also has these sort of like problematic things about gender and gender identity. And yeah, I don't know, but it's a really interesting book. And I know she has another book coming out, I think next year, and I'm really excited about it. So.
And she talks about identity in so many ways in Boy Snow Bird as well.
Yeah,
in terms of a person's personality, because Boy goes from being this very kind of traditional lost waif that you have quite a lot of sympathy for, and, you know, abandoned in the gutter. To then when she kind of gets a bit more status and a bit more privilege herself and is there presented with another younger woman, she sort of goes from being this sympathetic figure into more of kind of almost like Snow White stepmother.
The stepmother, right.
She becomes the evil stepmother.
Yeah. And I feel like similarly, I feel like she's doing a similar thing with that as Emma Donoghue does, which is this, like the way that Emma Donoghue reimagines this sort of figure of the stepmother a couple of times in various stories is really interesting. And I mean, it's not a coincidence that, with the exception of Confessions of the Fox, like all these books are by women. And I think, I think there's something really interesting about, yeah, like the way, and like even the image of the stepmother and like, what does that mean? And like, why is this such a trope in fairy tales? And what does it say about what we think about like women and mothers and what does it mean to be a mother? Yeah. It's just really, really interesting to me. And yeah, so I feel like she's doing something similar and playing with that idea of like what it means to be like a quote unquote, like wicked stepmother, an evil queen, you know, like that sort of idea in both of those books is really getting turned around in interesting ways.
Thank you very much for that. Carmen, that's all we've got time for, sadly. The rest of the book festival swells all around
And
I think we've all got places to be, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Even with your plane cold.
Well, thank you for having me.
Read Like a Writer was brought to you by Faber and Faber, Serpent's Tale and Canongate Books, and was presented by me, Anna Fielding. Carmen Maria McDardo's book, Her Body and Other Parties, is published by Serpent's Tale and it's out right now. To get a full list of what this week's author recommended, visit acast.com/readlikeawriter. And we'd love to hear what you think too, so do feel free to tweet us at readlikeapod. Thank you.
Hey marketers, want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.